A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
They're one of the greatest objects of them all. I placed a Tamiya motor car up there with a real motor car with a great wristwatch. With
the one thing they probably missed with all of it is that the car they launched looks bloody brilliant.
Who writes this shit? And how dare they not support such a special car with some worthwhile press words and photographs? This is utter shite. Hello and welcome to the Collecting Addicts podcast. Episode number, cue drumroll, 52. We're calling it a 1 year anniversary because we love an anniversary on this podcast. I need to warn you that I'm pulling up the claggy remnants of Monster Munch from my teeth. Why is it when they get compacted, they get in your teeth, you can't get them out? You could build a house with that material.
But first what flavour did you have?
Pickled onion, of course.
Pickled onion, it's the only one.
We're going to talk
about...
Can
you imagine if you did actually build a house with pickled onion Monster Munch? You just got hungry, just lick your walls, wouldn't you? And then get...
This is the best impression... The best digression we've ever had on the podcast. Before we even started, we're talking about building a house with food substances. I'll raise you cold Weetabix, Weetabix that's got wet and then been gone cold again. You can make a Formula One car. That is stronger than carbon fibre. No doubt about that.
Yeah, it's got weight to strength ratio is better than autoclaved carbon fibre.
It's beaten only by a heavily beaten mashed potato in a pan that's been there for a day. You can make a space shuttle out of that. That can handle, excuse the pun, re-entry. Now,
And that's the end of episode 52.
Neil Clifford's glasses are, as they say in France, you've got to get the pun here, pre-1993. Did you get the pun there?
Oh, yes. Yellow lenses.
I miss those.
We are going to move on to model cars. And I'm going to put this over to Neil Clifford because he chose the subject and he's now put his hat on. Neil, model cars.
Well, the thing is, Manish chose the subject.
Yep.
Ah.
And so we'll pass to Manish in a moment. You know, I've never really been into model cars. It's not a love-hate thing. I'm not going to stand here and say I detest model cars like I do sometimes moan about stuff. I just never really got into them. I think it's my scruffy nature of slight disorganization through life has never meant that I've collected a load of lovely model cars that I've kept for 20 years and they're all in a lovely cabinet. I've got lots of friends like that have these, whatever they're called, anagram or algram, expensive £4,000 models of Ferrari Testarossa.
Amalgam.
That's that. I've got friends with all of those things that, take great pride in them just have collections of those pretty little cars that are all shiny and they dust them every week. If I had them, I'd be dropping them, losing them, smashing them, they'd be all over the bloody place. So I'm more into real cars than model cars, I suppose, is my thing, really. I've got one here. There it is.
Yeah.
And I like that because I've got the real version of it.
Yeah.
Just over, yep. Just by his left elbow, literally.
Yeah.
Keeping it real for the podcast, for the people.
And a bird's custard van I was bought.
What make of van is that? I don't mean the manufacturer of the toy, but is
it's
it
a Morris?
It's a Morris. The manufacturer? Is it a Lesney or is it Matchbox or is it
That's the problem with model cars. You get all these strange people that want to know all the bloody details of what. It's just a piece of metal with rubber wheels.
I only asked.
Well, it's a Morris.
Oh, God.
But no, I've never, you know, even Scalextrics, I had it, I couldn't put it together, then it would break and the wheels would come off and I would lose bits. And it's not in my brain to enjoy model cars.
Blimey.
Miserable bastard.
A real
52 weeks.
I don't dislike them. I just never have got into them.
He's not a real addict.
A real glass half empty rant to start with there. We're talking over each other as well. So everyone just shut up and give each other some space to talk. Right. Chris Cooper, you go next.
I quite like model cars, if that's okay. I mean, it all started with model cars, didn't it? It started. My father always used to say to me, the first word that my brother and I said, and funnily enough, we weren't sitting in the back seat of a Porsche 911. Or some exotic BMW with rear headrests and rear cigar lighters. We were probably standing in the back seat of a Vauxhall Cresta or something like that. And he said, "Bygoes." He used to stand in the front back of the car, pointing out the window, going, "Bygoes." Those things are going by. And so he bought us some Matchbox toy cars. Mm. Actually, some of them might have been Lesney. Remember Lesney? And it was just, they were just wonderful. They just captivated us. It was just where the whole passion started for me, which was think what it would be like to have the real one of this, whatever it was. And you play around and you make all the broom broom noises. I still do actually when I'm by myself in the evening. It was just wonderful. The Corgi JPS Lotus 72.
Hmm.
Oh, just. Yeah. I think I see those occasionally on eBay thinking that would just be all of my childhoods all over again, having that one. We did have Scalextrix. And my brother and I would see how fast or how far you could make them fly if you put the track over the landing or something like that. And we would sort of, we discovered oversteer and low mu surfaces by putting fairy liquid on some of the corners or a bit of water. And the thing would, I remember having a Mark I Escort Mexico type thing, Scalextrix car, and just the wonderful fun and just seeing how it would just oversteer at quite slow speed around the corner because we had a bit of fairy liquid on the track. So, and then you discover Tamiya. And then you discover. So
I've never had one.
In my current list, I haven't made this one. Got that one to make. And I might have shown you one before, but I've got this one here.
Oh, you've shown us that. Yeah, that's cool.
One there. I'm going to make the tempting face if I ever break my arm or something. God, I didn't say that. And just stuff like this. This is just what was in my office at the moment. Do you recognize that monkey?
Yeah, I do.
You and I have both driven that.
Yeah.
That very car, this very car. This is the Eric van der Poel 1987 DTM winning car. Not this one.
It's just a stupid model.
I've raced that car on the Nürburgring in it. I just think it's just part of the memory. That shop at the... you've been to Nürburgring, Neil? Of course you haven't.
No.
No. So on the Moise Path Road. Anybody's been to the ring will know the ED petrol station and the toy car shop. You could just go in there and it's just got full of toy cars of every, not those amalgam ones. I'm with you on that. But I think model cars, building model kits, building the those Tamiya ones of F1 cars and thinking, that's what a wishbone is. That's what Ackerman's. It was all just really, really, it just, when you can't drive or you weren't going to school in the back of a 911, it was just how we got our passion. So all of my passion
that was
came.
Mine came.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah, that as well. Definitely that as well. Yeah. So model cars is, for me, is where it started.
I agree with all of that. Manish Pandey, who chose the subject, model cars.
Well, I chose it because I thought it's one of those things that it really is the bridge between imagination and addiction. And
the bridge between imagination and addiction.
Well, that's what I think when you're a child, you're probably you become obsessed. You're probably not addicted as a child. And it began exactly as it did with all of you. I think with Matchbox cars, they were affordable. I remember my father, when he was a junior doctor at the hospital, he used to, at St. James's Hospital in Ballow, it's closed now, but he used to smoke like a chimney. And on the Sundays he wasn't on call, he'd often give me a fiver and say, go to the post office, the local, it's the only thing that was open in the morning, newsagents. And he'd say, buy me my whatever he used to smoke. I can't remember what he used to smoke. He'd say, buy me my newspaper, get yourself some sweets and something else that you want. And I think Matchbox cars were sort of like 30p at the time, weren't they, in the 70s? They were utterly affordable. And I basically built a collection by being my father's cigarette provider, you know, on a Sunday morning. It's amazing, isn't it? In those days, they would give a child.
Yes.
Oh, six, a packet of cigarettes for my dad. Like that, you know. But it did start with those. And I remember there was a very bad Lamborghini Countach that Matchbox made, because they all had the same details and everything. And I fell in love with the shape of this car as a Matchbox toy at some point in the 70s. And I still remember buying my first Countach LP400 Tamiya kit. And just looking at the body and just not understanding how a body could be that shape, could be that beautiful. The thing that absolutely floored me were the pop-up headlamps and the lights at the back, just those funny anhedral, that shape. And I actually got into making cars in quite a big way in my 20s. So it sounds nuts, but look at that. I mean, just look at that.
I was doing very different things in my 20s to you, I think.
Neil, you know what it was? Just from my teens to my 20s, you know, even as a, before, I think it was before I began writing. So I bought an airbrush. I had every kind of sanding device. I discovered photo etch parts. And in fact, the very, very last car that I built was the Gerhard Berger version of the F189 1/120th scale Tamiya. And I did it with photo etch parts, because a friend of mine was really in love with it. It took me weeks to build this thing on sort of, you know, minutes off here and there. And I remember when I painted it, put the decals on, then I put the lacquer on top, hanging the body upside down in my bathroom, because that was the most dust-free place before polishing this thing. And it was just the most joyous experience, giving it to him in a Perspex box. And he thought it was an amalgam model. And you know what I think was about, because I'd given up basically surgery by then. I just wasn't using my hands.
I hadn't thought about that.
It was a real way
for me. You're probably very good at doing that. Would you come round in the school holidays?
Yes.
Before we have to go home for tea? Could you come round and you and I are going to make this together?
I will bring my compressor. I will bring my tools. I've got so many tools.
You've got to do that.
The paints are probably all dead by now. But I was just going to say that the last part of this is something that I haven't quite got into, and it's exactly what Neil got at, the concept of amalgam models. Because I think you could spend a couple of £100 on something, maybe if you've got a bit of money, maybe a little bit more, but the amalgam models do take it to a different level, an entry-level car there. And they say unashamedly, these are perfect scale replicas. They don't have opening doors. You know, they don't, that's not what they're built to be. They're built to be perfect sculptures. And so they go from several hundred to several thousand pounds. And they are objects of absolute beauty. But I will take it one step further. A very good friend of mine who is into Ferraris he has a man in Italy who builds him, and they're absolutely crazy. I think they are 1/6 scale working cars.
Yeah.
He's got a GTO. Wow. He's got the Lancia D50. He's got the 57 Testarossa. He's got, I've said it, 250 GTS. One other he's got. And they are beautiful. The doors open, the pistons work, the gearbox works, the suspension. I mean, it takes two people to lift them up. I mean, these things are literally 60 kilos worth of car. They are the most, terrifying amount to buy. I mean, you'd buy a real car for those. So it's an amazing scale of things. And I think, God, you know, something I'll be in love with forever. Neil, sorry.
Neil's not going to be converted here.
No, I sort of admire it. I don't understand it. What's the point of buying a car, a thing that's like for midgets, when you can get a real car and actually drive the bloody thing as opposed to having a little miniature thing that you just look at? I mean, I don't understand. I wish I did understand it a little bit more, but I don't really.
It is. I was just reminded of something that I saw on, well, someone showed me, he's on Facebook, a guy that made an escort model out of it. He made it like it was jewellery. And I just tried to Google crazy escort model and something really, my web browser just went, no.
And yeah, other things came up.
Please so confirm you are over 18.
Work that one out a second. Right, Edward, model cars, did they touch you or not?
Yes, they did. My bedroom. My grandfather was a very big collector of model cars. He, back in the day, and this is on my mother's side, not my father's side. And back in the day,
sorry, that explains it. Cooper's on the Red Bull. That's why he's thinking. If it's Blockbusters, he's buzzing before the end of the question. That's why. Here we go. Come on, everyone.
Back in the day, like every Formula One car from every season, oh, for goodness sake. every Formula One car from every season and every livery for every driver, there was a model of those cars. And for every BTC car or for entry to Le Mans. And my grandfather collected all these cars. And if you ever have the opportunity to go to the BRDC at Silverstone, you'll see a lot of those models on display there. And my father raced in period. So there's great, you know, you can go to the Essen or not any of the motor shows, Retromobile Essen, and you go into the sort of auto jumble areas and you could look through there for the car that my father drove at Le Mans in the 70s or the 80s. So that was always fun. But as a very young child, if you have a toy car put in your hands, you can't go and drive it. You're probably too young to use remote control cars. So I think for a lot of us, it did start there. My room was covered in it. I remember back in the day, I think there was a Shell petrol station next to what was the Dick Lovett Mercedes-Benz showroom back in the day in Swindon. And my father used to go and fill up his car on the way home, and you collected the points when every time you filled up, and every time you got a certain amount of points, they gave you one of these Shell-sponsored car models they were giving away. And every 2 or 3 weeks, my father would come back and give me one of those models in a box. And because my grandfather was a collector, I always kept the box. I always kept the packaging, and it would go up on the shelf, and I be excited to wait for the next one. I loved micro machines as well. And as you grew older, you then probably got into a remote control car. And then you got a little bit older than that. And if you were super lucky, you might have got a quad bike or some sort of other device that you could start driving. And then, yes, the addiction gets a lot more expensive and a lot more real. But my son's 4 years old. And whenever we travel with this bag. And we've got too many cars now to go in the bag, but Chris is holding up his 934, but he's got his little 934 in the GT3 RS, Bugatti Chiron Super, Bugatti Veyron Super Sport, Boxster GTS, new 935. What's that? A Chiron Pure Sport. Nissan GTR. He's got 30 of them.
Can I come round and play with those as well? I love that.
He knows every model. And I shared this video with you at Christmas. Yeah. He knows every model of the car, and he knows every engine in every car. And it starts there.
Yeah. Cool.
So
I'm loving this. Neil Clifford.
I'm a believer.
Neil Clifford has been cast as the grumpy old man. I'm loving it.
I think it's cool. I'm feeling rather like I've missed something in my life.
Look, this email has just arrived. Look, from Cars24, Spark.
Okay. Right. Phone's listening to you.
Allow me to summarise a bit. I love the stories. I agree with all of it. I also agree with Neil Clifford in many ways. So I separate toy cars into probably three categories. There's the child relationship with toy cars. There's the adult relationship with toy cars. And then there's remote control cars or radio control cars afterwards. I think I agree with all of those stories about the bond. If you look at the genesis of your passion for the automobile, much of it will be down to the toy car. And I think if it isn't, you've had an anomalous way into having a car passion. Most of us, if you're a certain age, were given toy cars and we use those to support our imagination. We went on adventures with them. They were our friends. And I think that motley collection of toys that you had, you didn't necessarily choose. You were given them. So, you know, quite often your favourite Formula One driver was the one that drove the car that you were given for Christmas. You didn't choose. So that stuff I think is wonderful. And you built up this collection, this merry bunch of things to go on adventures with. And I remember I had a majorette Renault 14. You know, I don't know what that was about. Majorette Renault 16, all sorts of random stuff because the shop next door used to sell them. The adult relationship with toy cars is different for me. I'm a bit like Neil Clifford here. I don't want a room full of toy cars. I don't play with them anymore. I like real cars. But I do think I like having toy cars that are of relevance to me. So like your 365 there, if I can have a model of something that there we go, Chris Cooper's got there. Chris Cooper's showing a model of a car we raced together, and my name's not on it, which is annoying. And Neil Clifford's showing a picture of a yellow 365, which he owns. So I think the significance is that you have a model of a car that's significant to you. You might have driven it, your mate might have owned it, you might have lusted after it, and that means I don't have many toy cars, but I do have certain cars that I raced and cars that I've owned. So I get that, I really do. And the idea of just having a room full of toy cars that don't mean anything to me is a bit
odd. That's right.
People that have these collections on YouTube, or on Instagram, you sometimes get pushed a picture of an incredible collection, and I go, wow, if I owned that, I would be up against all of them all day long looking at the descriptions.
Yeah.
Because they have the shape of the motor car. Part of the car obsession, the addiction, is being addicted to the form of the motor car, I think. Yeah. So Tamiya is a bit different. Cards on the table. I have it on my crash helmet, and I adore them. I think they're wonderful because they were the first time I really understood suspension systems, different designs, making a car from scratch. I mean, they were just they're one of the greatest objects of them all. I placed a Tamiya motor car up there with a real motor car, with a great wristwatch, with, I don't know, the things that I enjoy most in life. I Mr. Tamiya, I can't thank him enough, really. He's brought untold joy to mine and other people's lives. So I think that's how I categorize them. The child relationship with toy cars is a bit different to the adult one. But there's one type of toy car we've never really discussed. Now, these were available, I think, in the 70s and 80s. I think they died out after that. But these were my favorite toy cars as a child. I think they were German, and they were called Dada cars. Do you know who remembers those?
No.
Dada cars, no.
They had a little spring motor inside them, and you draw them back.
Oh, that's right.
And yeah. They had
real speed. And you could buy a crack. Now, I remember when about 10 years ago, I bought a load of old Dada track and some old Dada cars off eBay, set it up in my then flat, and was playing along with them, my sort of four-year-old child. And he couldn't believe how good they were. So if you can find a Dada car, that's for me peak toy car, because you could buy a 911 Targa that would do about 8 miles an hour just by drawing it back on itself. It was just magnificent.
Did they have that sort of coil spring?
They had a circular motor that was black and red on one side and wound up against each other inside the chassis. They were mid-engined. Yeah. I think it was DAR, DA car.
Chris, just what I was going to say was that there's one thing I do, and I don't do it often, but I would say about once a month. If I'm really stressed, especially in the evening, you know, you've had a bad week, bad day, bad whatever. One thing I have found on YouTube is they vary between sort of 15 minutes and half an hour, and they are. It is an expert literally building a car. And one of the ones, I mean, especially the Senna sort of Formula One ones or Ferraris, and you'll see someone literally cutting the sprue, building it, polishing the thing. And he does it 30 minutes, what would take me 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And such a relaxing thing. I know it sounds mad, but I come out of that going, okay, I think I can sleep. You see something being made that's beautiful and being made beautifully.
We might now post a link to one of those on the screen.
I've just been looking at them, yeah. And this car here, which doesn't have your name on it.
Oh, God.
And it doesn't have your name on it. This is a car we raced together for years and years and years at the ring. It's my happiest memories. Many of them are in that car. But I do have the car from this year that does have your name on it. But it doesn't
The
one that's in the museum.
I know. Well,
I got that because it meant something to me. Because my mate had this amazing experience with Volta Roland, all those people in the factory, and you had that amazing finish in the 2010 Nürburgring 24 Hour Race. So when we were in the shop one day, I thought, I need to buy that one as well, because that means something to me as well. So you're right. It's got to mean something.
They're special things, and I think they have a place in the Petrohead heart. And I think Neil Clifford is going to go away and reassess his relationship with the model car.
I'm a bit old to do that, really. I think I'm pretty much stuck in my ways. Because I don't have the dexterity, patience, or skill to actually sit and make anything. If I try to do anything practical, I will fuck it up and make it worse. It doesn't get me going because I know I wouldn't do it well. That's why my tunnel into cars was, if anything, it was facts and
information. Yeah, no, those are really, facts
and information of looking at real cars, not to say model cars are in inferior. It's just, I could remember all the numbers, and this was the data that was interesting to me.
Is this true? I think that there was a ubiquity to the model car. They were available in just about every shop, every garage, but top trumps were much harder to come by as a kid.
One thing, obviously, given we're all of similar age, I didn't grow up in the city. I grew up in the countryside. So, you know, but having a model car at an age where I couldn't go and get on a bus and go in and look at what these real cars or go to motor shows, that was the only way of interacting with something. Wow, this isn't this cool. Nowadays, you've got Gran Turismo. You can play on your mobile phone. True. You can go into central London and become a car spotter. You know, there are so many touch points now to go and see the. I used to love, you know, going to a motor show was like playing with model cars. I wasn't going to drive any of them. They were the real thing. They were still model cars. I couldn't touch them. Maybe touch them, but I was never going to drive them.
Yeah, it's true. I never went to motor shows either.
Yeah.
Right. Moving on. No one's allowed to interrupt until I say speak. You've got to listen to this. Aston Martin yesterday launched the heavily revised V8 Vantage with over 660 horsepower as an entry-level car, a fact I love. And I think it's the type of car Aston Martin should be making. My colleagues can discuss that in a minute. Before they're allowed to interject, I want to read the wording on the Aston Martin Instagram account that describes this new vehicle. Forged in the fires of the limit, not just a shrine to lap times, but standing as a symbol to thrill seekers, putting you in constant conversation with the road and freeing you with the trust to go further, comma, throttle harder and revel at the limit. Don't say anything, anyone. There's another one. A dedication to drivers, designed to rise above the banal conversations about lap times. Tweaked, refined, and set free with a 4-litre twin-turbo V8 engine, 800 newton metres of torque, and 665 horsepower of pure power. Created to grip tarmac and send it running through every inch of aluminium, carbon, and steel, reverberating through your senses. Now, before we discuss the car and the car company, and one of the images accompanying it was so badly CGI'd that it's a car that somehow is rolling the wrong way into an oversteer corner with its rear tyre in midair, I don't think I've read such utter horseshit written by a car company since the same car company wrote the script about keen harpists in their spare time. Who writes this shit? And how dare they not support such a special car with some worthwhile press words and photographs? This is utter shite. I'm sorry, it really is. Chris Cooper.
It is pretty shite, and it's similarly shite as when the DBX arrived and that ridiculous advert, when they seemed to feel they had to explain what Aston Martin was. And they said that the DBX had been baptized in the flames of adventure. I mean, we're going to come on to it, because this is kind of what I want to talk about. It is because what is Aston Martin? And what do we think about it? And where's it going? And how does it make us feel? Somebody somewhere must have surely stopped to think, do you know what? We keep banging on about our brand and British Ferrari and James Bond and so forth. Why are we focused on this guffology? It's just awful. It's just awful.
Did you just say guffology?
Guffology. I did say guffology.
That is the word. That is the word. Because this is nothing but it's air. It's methane from the colon. It's not normal air.
The one thing they probably missed with all of it is that the car they launched looks bloody brilliant, and it's got a ton of power. And so it just needed a great photograph and no words. It should have just launched. It should have read, "The new Aston Martin Vantage, available now."
Yeah.
Get some.
I think that's right.
Ed would love it, a job in the marketing department, Aston Martin. But I also, I'm not sure some of this is English.
Chris, I was about to say, do you think there's some form of translational issue here? I mean, this is designed to be read in Chinese, perhaps, Arabic, possibly.
I'm not sure I've met anyone who likes cars that would enjoy reading that and think about going to buy one. They just look at the photo, I want that car. And by the way, that GT3 version of it, that is a handsome-looking racing car.
It is.
The whole thing looks...
Yes, that one there.
Yeah.
Entry-level little Aston with 665 horsepower, a proper interior. I mean, what's not to love? But talk about throwing a banana skin in front of yourselves. You just don't need it, do you? And also, the film starts with Alonso in the sort of fetal position. I mean, it just looks
in
like...
a wheelbarrow.
Yeah, it looks like he should be in a mobility scooter. Mm. It's terrible.
I mean, they're lucky that no one actually that is a buyer is going to read that shit.
Yeah. That's for
12-year-olds, isn't it?
Hopefully.
I think they might be confused by reading it also.
But I think it's a really, really great-looking car. The performance is going to be outrageous. And I'll tell you why it worked for me, people. I'll make an admission. Yesterday, I had an hour and a half when I wasn't scribbling or doing something, and I wanted to get some of the crap off my car. I have the car washed once every 4 months when the dirt is too much. So I went down to the guys, the Scratch and Shine, down in Winstoke Road in Bristol. And after that, I thought, I'm going to go to the Aston Martin garage. They've launched a car today. They deserve some footfall. But quite often I find when a new car's launched, it gets me to go to a showroom to have a look around at the old stuff. Because the moment, you know, an addict behaviour is, if there's a new one, that means the old ones are going to become cheaper. That's what we all do, isn't it? There must be a bargain to be had. So I went to Aston Martin Bristol and was met by a salesman who was just lovely. And I'll say his name in a minute. And they, you know, he tried very hard to sell me a car in the most polite way possible. they told me it was the best, the biggest best-selling Aston dealership in the country. They're very proud of the product. I looked at DBS's, which there was a couple at 120 something grand. What a really? Car! They're, honestly, wow. there was a midnight blue.
Yeah, you sent us
DBS at Aston Bristol. Honestly, if you're thinking about buying a super sports car at the moment, if you see that thing, your hand in your pocket straight
How
away.
How many miles do you have on it?
Quite a few, high 20, 25, 26. But it just made me go and sort of re-engage with the brand. I've slightly ignored it for a while. And I have to say, I love their cars. I love the front-engine GT thing. And what I like about what's happening in Aston Martin at the moment is, for all its troubles and for all the speculation out there, it's making Aston Martins. I know they all look a bit samey, but they're front-engined, very powerful cars in which ordinary people can pretend they're James Bond. That's really what an Aston Martin is for me on the road. I don't care about, you know, there was a Valkyrie in the showroom and I couldn't really be asked to look at it. I wanted to look at all the big, muscular, haunchy. If you asked me to choose the best Aston Martin in the last 20 years, it'd be one I haven't driven. It'd be the 177. I think it's still one of the best looking road cars ever made.
Yeah.
You can keep the Valkyrie on that front. So I like the renewed interest in the brand. I'm really pleased they've made this car. But whoever signed off that non-sideways CGI image, find it on Instagram, and those words needs lobotomizing because it's shite.
Are they reliable?
In general, they've made very few design errors, haven't they? In the last. DB7 wasn't I wasn't a big fan of it, but I think I said on a podcast a few weeks ago that I think the DB9's a great looking car.
Yeah, it is, sort of
timeless design, and you know the first V8 Vantage was great. The first modern iteration of V8 Vantage was a great little package. A bit underwhelming to drive, but it was a great looking car. And,
are they reliable, Edward?
Yeah, I think so. No worse than anything else out there. You know, there's probably a few little issues here and there with electronics, but nothing major. You generally don't see them parked by the side of the road with owners in distress.
We spent time with, Luca's old man, Felisa, was there and will be there, you know, just for a very short time. And he always used to say that he felt that as a brand, it was just, you know, his word. He loves that word. It's a fantastic brand. He always felt a fantastic brand. It just needed just that right little bit of alchemy to put it right back there. It just needed
what it needs is full ownership from Mercedes or Geely, and it just needs to be rebodied AMG cars with beautiful interiors and lovely designed bodies.
But Mr. Not Cooper, horrible. Is this brand going to survive on the road?
I mean, yes. I mean, it's about 26 years ago, just as I was setting up my firm, we did a bit of work with Aston Martin. And I went to Bloxham, remember the old TWR factory where they made DB7? It was actually when DB7 was being made. And I met with the CEO, a guy called Bob Dover. Sounds like he should be in a porn film.
Yeah,
He is a esteemed British motor industry executive. And he was trying to sort out, because he was when Ford had it. And his commercial kind of marketing director, a guy called Bill Donnelly, who some people listening just will know, both very impressive people. And they said, our brand is sports priority, which I never really understood. When they were about to launch the Vanquish with that rather fragile gearbox, and they said, we're Britain's Ferrari. And I remember thinking, I'm not sure that's necessarily going to be, I mean, I get what you're saying, it should be, but always trying to aspire to something else that's not you never really feels like strong enough identity. And James Bond by itself is, it is James Bond. It's the coolest thing in the world. It should be the world's coolest brand. And for a long time, it has always been in those lists of the world's coolest brands, the world's coolest. So I do think it is going to. There was something that Lawrence Stroll was reported as saying recently. He said, so I've invested in all these factories for F1 and for the road cars. I've saved the brand, saved it. I should have a knighthood. And you kind of think, yeah, it's typical Lawrence. But actually, he's not done bad. Mm-hmm. It's not done bad. You think of where it was before. I mean, those cars are... And really, we take the mick out of the marketing. I have a nasty feeling that Lawrence would have looked at that and said, I like the sound of those words.
Yeah, no. I have to separate the what they're doing from those words.
Yeah. So I think, no, the product's been a bit weak. I mean, if you could get completely bogged down with how has that business been run and owned and so forth, and so many people have had half-hearted goes at it. But now it feels like there's some half-sensible people. Who knows who next year will be? I love it.
I've got to be honest here. The corporate side of it, the numbers... Many of you that listen to this will probably be aware of a guy called Secret Supercar Owner who does these fantastic deep dive investigations into company finances. Now, he's had a field day with Aston Martin for years.
Carinable.com.
Yeah, Carinable.
Yeah.
You can almost hear him licking his lips. I don't know the guy's name. That's why there's secret in his name. But he clearly has a financial background and he just forensically pulls things apart. He clearly thinks Aston Martin is more and more and more in the poop. There's more and more debt. Oh, Cooper's having a pizza or something, or a toast.
No, it's pancake day.
Oh, is it? Of course it's pancake day, right. From what he writes, Aston Martin is just further and further in the shite, and really it's a waiting game before Geely comes and buys it all, which is fair enough. And I think we all hope that Aston Martin is such a cool brand, it will survive, beyond maybe brands that deserve to last longer than Aston Martin, given how many times it's gone wrong. But there's a concerted effort now. The cars, sadly, I don't think are selling as well as they should. And I fear for Aston Martin that it's arriving with the right cars at the wrong time. It's arrived with this V8 Vantage at a time when most people aren't wanting to spend that much money on a new super sports car. Whereas 5 years ago, they were spending a lot of money on shite. So...
Well, I don't disagree with that. You know, they are... clearly a sports car brand. You know, they've tried hard with their four-door version and, you know, obviously to launch the DBX, which having driven a DBX, I haven't driven a 707. I actually think it's a really good car. But they would have to do something wildly radical that's wildly away from what their brand represents to really have an easy life. And, you know, that's like McLaren... are still struggling financially with more and more capital injections coming left, right, and centre because they build one car, they build a sports car. You know, whether you go the full hog or not, you know, they're two-seater sports cars. And unless you want them to build a diesel saloon and a Tesla Model 3 competitor, I think it's that's why, you know, we've talked about it before. It's there's going to continue to be some consolidation out there, and there's probably only going to be a handful of brands that can survive.
Yep.
Neil Clifford, would you own a Midnight Blue 120,000 pounds DBS Superleggera?
This is a very complicated discussion, isn't it, Aston Martin? Because we all love the brand, whether it be James Bond, whether it be the fact that the cars are beautiful, the fact that it's British, the fact that we want to be all positive about it. The cars are generally pretty. I think the Vantage, not this new one, but the one that was new yesterday, I didn't think it was that pretty. Actually, that was a bit of a cock up, that car. And frankly, they haven't changed the back of the new one. The back's still crap. That's why they haven't done any photographs of the back. But I think in general, they're pretty cars. I've owned one and none of you guys own one. And not many people
that's not true. I own 5 GT8s at one stage.
Yeah, but to just make money on them. That's not to enjoy the bloody thing.
I didn't make any money on them. I tried to.
I didn't enjoy them and I didn't make any money
on them. I'm just trying to connect the dots in my head a bit because you know, this is where I started, not in model cars. It's not just about what things look like. It's not a pair of shoes, a car. A man, we study data, we read journalists, we want the dynamically the best car as well as the prettiest car. And I think they had a ratio of 70% pretty, 30% good dynamically. The ratio wasn't correct. Therefore, the man smelled it out. And it was bought by the man, in my very humble opinion, which is maybe quite a controversial thing to say, that was more image than he, because he wants to be James Bond. If you buy an Aston Martin, you just want to be fucking James Bond. But you don't dynamically care that it's not as good as a Porsche or Ferrari or sometimes even Lamborghini. And I think that's the challenge that Lawrence and the team have got. Dynamically, the car's got to be quite a lot better because I've owned one. I never drove it. I had better things to enjoy. And then I sold it.
I think that's a fair observation, and people are out there looking for something different. And if you want to just buy the best all round sports car, you're going to probably go and buy something like a 992 turbo. But you know, then everyone's going to be driving around in 992 turbos, and that's where Aston Martin builds a big boy.
Rowan Atkinson was meant to be this massive Aston Martin fan. About 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, he sort of said, "Look, enough."
Yeah, he had a V8 Vantage like me, which I was never really a DB5, DB6, DB4 guy. I mean, they're pretty. You admire them like you do a vintage Patek, but I've driven one. It's like a tractor.
Yeah.
It's not that.
Would you be excited about going to take delivery of your own specified new V12 Velour, or however it's pronounced?
I think the Velour, which is, you know, off the back of the Victor, basically, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah.
I think that is really cool looking, really cool looking. Would I go and do 165 grand on the Vanquish with that R sticking up in the air? No, I wouldn't. Because it's like you've gone and had your hair cut and he hasn't done the back.
That's actually... one thing that has happened with DBS... in particular, they launched that at a time which normally it would have depreciated very heavily, but because of the demand issues or supply chain issues in the motor industry during COVID, you know, they ended up, their residuals held very, very well, and they actually went up in price. But yeah, now when you know the used Aston Martin market's always, there's always been some great deals to be had. So when Chris talks about a DBS at 127 grand, you know, that's probably a good buy.
That is quite. I had a DB9 convertible.
Pretty car. Yeah.
2010. And I didn't really fit it. And when you had the roof down and tried to sort of press it, it did rather fall apart. So quite quickly, and I was, you and I and Guy Spur were racing in Germany at the time, and I tried to keep it sort of a bit private, that I thought it was a bit shit. But eventually I kind of gave in. And amazingly, a motor trader in the Wiltshire area offered me an enormously attractive used trade-in price for it, for a German car.
I think we all want to like it. It's like the royal family, right? You don't want to criticize anything. I mean, it's, you know, it's British and it's got all that history, and it was created 3 miles from me. The Aston Clinton Road is just up here. Yeah. It's, you know, we all want to adore it. I just, you know, I've owned ridiculous amount of cars because I'm stupid, and I've had one Aston Martin and I never drove it, and I sold it because it's just nicer to drive other stuff. If this thing is lovely to drive, you know, we all want it to be successful, don't we? I think.
So what would make you buy an Aston Martin now, Neil? How would you get over the, I think they're shit, I had one I didn't drive, I like other stuff.
I'll let you into a
secret. How would they get you to buy one? What would
happen? I'll let you into a secret. It's going to form part of my two-car garage.
Okay.
Oh. So as in my dream world, I'm always buying Aston Martins, you know, because we're always searching. Only look at that British Racing Green Vantage 2005, 39995 manual. I'm always dreaming to buy one, but in the end, you don't, do you? Because they're not quite good enough dynamically, because whether it be Chris Harris, whether it be other journalists, when you know... How many Astons are a 5-star car in here? Not many.
DBS was pretty good.
Can Neil go last on the two car garage, and I'm going to change mine.
Yeah. Okay. Manish, any thoughts on Aston?
No, I mean, We've spoken about this before, and I mean,
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
They are beautiful things, and I think Neil's just hit it exactly on it. It's this beautiful thing from the outside. A friend of mine did buy a new one, I think it was 20 years ago, and the throttle cable went on his very, very first journey. I think Rowan Atkinson complained about the flywheel, and you do get this sense that it's just sort of struggled from model to model. I remember the Financial Times, I think the only two times they've said, do not buy something on their front pages are Aston Martin and Soho House. That's my kind of understanding of it. Like, do not buy this. This is not going to work. And that's why what I did see was the debt, just doing a bit of Googling. It's $1.1 billion. That's not an insane or astronomical sum of money for a Geely to just write a little check for. But I guess they're going to do that on the basis that they can do something clever with the brand. And I saw also the year's earnings are going to be out at the end of this month. They report at the end of February. So that will be interesting. And just as an adjunct, just the Formula One team. I didn't know that Lawrence Stroll had sold a little chunk of shares in that a while ago to a company called Arctos, which I decided to have a quick look at. Classic private equity, do some sports investments. So, you know,
the brand is brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredibly strong, isn't it, to survive all the ups and downs that it's been through. And we all want it to be successful.
Who's going
to
be the new CEO when Felisa goes? I mean, who's going to get that?
Matthew Beard.
I think that's one of the least desirable jobs.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I think you're...
Yes, I agree.
The idea of managing that sort of level of debt, a difficult set of difficult market circumstances, and Mr. Stroll sitting above you, I think I'd rather go and just clean cars down at Winstoke Road with Scratch and Shine Boys, frankly.
Well, Lawrence is the CEO.
So
he's
the
executive chairman, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's and actually, you know, he's a very, very, very smart bloke.
Yeah.
And he is the CEO, whatever his title is. Yeah. He's making every single...
He's in charge.
He's in charge.
Yeah.
Right. Before we answer the question, old heaters are better, I want to just continue the occasional series. The new M5 I just bought isn't turning out to be quite the success story I'd hoped. So, just to update you, I've had the whole rear suspension rebuilt and the whole front suspension rebuilt. At not that much money, everything in. Dara's has been fantastic. But on Sunday, the M5 failed to complete its first journey, which I was told was inevitable anyway. And it stopped on the off-ramp from the M4 going to the M32 heading westbound. And to all of you hundreds of people that waved at me and shouted things at me, some of which weren't polite, I want to say hello back. And to those of you that weren't polite, fuck you too. I've now found out that something's gone wrong with there's a slave thingy and something else has gone wrong on the SMG, and if the engine ignition was on for too long and the pump was whirring and there wasn't any lubrication in the pump because we'd lost all the fluid, then the pump will be dead, which means the gearbox will be dead. So this is quite the project. It's a bit more than I'd bargained for. I knew they were unreliable, but this is a tricky vehicle. So I've come up with a solution. I don't know whether this is going to work or not. I've I'm now understanding too late that to run an S85 engined M5, you need to have another car whilst that might not be working. It is in itself a two-car garage. So I'm either going to buy an RS6 that I can run when the M5 Touring isn't running, but in my head I'll still be running an M5 Touring. So I've got like a reserve. I've got a benched RS6, but I don't really want to drive it, but I will. Or, and this is what I'm discussing with Dara, we buy another S85 Touring. Because if you've got two, you can guarantee it's a better chance one will be running.
So yeah,
I've asked him to find me another so that we can just rotate them.
Chris, there's supposed to be this story, isn't there, of an old woman who always walks onto a plane with a bomb in her handbag. And every time she gets stopped by the by the security guys, she goes, "Why do you have a bomb in your handbag?" She goes, "Well, you never hear of a plane with two bombs on it, do you?" Just described it.
I don't think it's a bad idea. And I tell you what, I'm not angry at all. I'm re-engaging with cars that require some emotional commitment. I've spent too long driving new cars that are within warranty and all very good. I stood by the side of the road on Sunday. It was totally inconvenient. I'd come back from watching the rugby, still had a beer head. It was, 1 in the afternoon, but I still felt shit. And I just thought it was funny, not that it was great. And I thought most of the interactions I had were kind. And the AA were superb. Dave from the AA and the guys from the highway rescue, whatever people, they were wonderful as well. I got to talk. I had conversations I wouldn't have. It's a great conversation giver breaking down. It's a segue into meeting new people. So I'm loving the process. The car's now been recovered at vast expense back to Dara. And I think I've done 3,000 miles in the car and it's cost me about £5,000 so far. And I think we're about to press the green light maybe on a manual gearbox or another SMG. And I reckon it's going to cost me £20,000 this month to keep her going. But it's worth it. It's worth every single penny. And then I'll buy another one to keep it going.
Yeah.
Right, moving on. Old heaters are better. This was written by Neil Clifford after he'd been driving around in his recreation Bentley, I reckon. Can you correct me there or not?
No. This came out of my wife's mouth, because when she's very, very suspicious of anything that's old, and as I've mentioned before, the first question is, are we going to get there if we jump in the R107 or the bloody whatever old piece of crap I'm driving around in because I think it looks nice? And one thing she said was, oh my God, old car heaters are so much better than new heaters. She's got a lovely Mark 8? I suppose it's Mark 8. Yeah. Old R. You could drive all the way to Aberdeen before it gets warm in there. You can't actually very easily get a new car toasty. I'm not talking about slightly warm. I'm talking about Mercedes of the 80s toasty, where you can literally like make a toasted sandwich on the dashboard. And I'm sure there's very sort of saving the planet reasons for this, but it's sort of annoying that new cars heaters are shit.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. And I'm sure
they're all like diesels now, aren't they? Everyone who's ever had a diesel, you think in the winter it will take you the rest of time for the diesel engine to warm up.
There's nothing like a Mercedes R107 heater. Literally, you can burn your feet within 5 minutes, can't you?
Because the engine management and the emissions management and all that kind of important green sustainability agenda we have all subscribed to, basically in new cars says you can't take too much heat out of the engine to put it into the heater, because we need the engine to warm up quickly and get to a temperature, and therefore there's less heat to be retained or taken out. And I guess it must also be something to do with combustion efficiency and all those kind of things. So there's just less heat in the cooling system because less fuel's being burnt, less energy is being burnt. In old cars, more energy is being consumed because the cars are less fuel efficient. I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about all the things I didn't learn in my thermodynamics courses in the 3 months I actually stayed doing mechanical engineering in the University of Portsmouth. But yeah, all that says you're right. Although, oddly, obviously, electric vehicles don't rely on anything. They heat up bloody quick because it's just like a little, like the old London taxis, like the old cheapy, chirpy, chappy London taxis with that electric heater in the footwell that Caterham's had.
So Neil needs an i3 or a Tesla Model 3.
Or a London taxi.
I wouldn't mind an i3. I'd have an i3. I wouldn't. I'd rather be dead than drive a Tesla.
Yeah.
But you'd get warm and toasty quickly.
Yeah, have an i3. i3 is still brilliant.
Wear a hat.
Wear a jumper.
My favourite of the heaters was a friend of mine had a Series 1 Land Rover when we first started to drive together. And actually, they were worth nothing then. No one cared about them. But it had that heater that was down in between the seats, that sort of shin leather.
Taxi heater.
With the flaps that you could... Yeah. And you had a flap you could just direct perfectly onto your shin.
Yeah.
And it gave the most perfect amount of heat to your tootsies. It was lovely.
Yeah, yeah. I've got
Volvo 244 DL. That had a heater. That would just... And also it would demist it faster than Usain Bolt could run 100 metres. They were unbelievable.
Who's driven a truck with an Ebisch, what they call Ebisch Sparker in? Those, the diesel-fired heaters. Yeah. They're sensational, aren't they?
Yeah. My Defender's got one.
Yeah.
I've got a 356 with one, a 1963 356 with one of those.
One of those.
Petrol heaters in the front, and you know, you hear it ignite, you switch it to the middle, and you hear the flames start going, and then the smoke starts coming out from under the wheel arches.
Yeah.
And then in 5 minutes, you literally could cook a chicken inside the cockpit. It's bloody fantastic.
Go and drive a Morgan Aeromax and get the heat off the transmission tunnel.
Yeah. Go and ride a Ducati Panigale R 2019, because that's got a nut heater on it that is beyond all others. your pods are warm. You could be in the Arctic and you'd be warm on that bad boy. I can tell you, man, I've had my children.
Yeah.
The concept of a cold car is interesting, actually, and this is slightly off on a tangent, but a vehicle that warms up too slowly is a poor companion, because you might not have a very long journey.
Yeah.
Your only interaction with that car is it being a bit cold and frosty.
Yeah.
I had a long-term Jaguar lent me ages ago. The it was a twin turbo diesel. What was the F not F type? What was the
big turbo?
XF.
Yeah, sorry.
The one that was a sort of five series rival.
Yeah, XF.
Excellent. Sorry, my brain's getting old. They had a twin turbo diesel they put in it, and in that sort of a 535D rival. And then where we lived was about a 10-mile drive on, I mean, sensational A roads to get to the motorway. So yeah, as a drive mix, I was just blessed for 10 years of my life. You get onto this quiet Welsh A road, spank it to the motorway. It was a road that had everything. Everything in terms of undulation, straights, narrows. It was gorgeous. This car was inert. Its dampers were solid for 9.7 miles every morning. And then they would just free up as I got to the fucking motorway.
That's annoying.
I couldn't understand. I phoned up Jaguar and said, what's this all about? I've got this, the dampers don't work. It's lumpy. It doesn't ride. And then just when I get to the motorway, it works because, the dampers take some time to free up in the morning. So, this car's useless for my... And I think the car not heating up is a bit like that as well. We can rely on an auxiliary bum warmer, but a bum warmer is a bit different. It's comforting, but it's not a full body hug, is it? Heat you is different to your spine being warmed.
Yeah, I like having the heater on and the windows open, or the sunroof. If you've got the heater on... You know, a 930 turbo with the heater in the middle, within 3 minutes, you've got to turn it down to one. Oh, it's too hot otherwise. But then you undo the sunroof. Oh, that's joyful. That is.
anyone else? I think we're agreeing that old heaters are better, except they're in EVs, when they're in EVs. So we're confusing today. Everyone got old heaters?
Say that again.
Anything to add on old heaters?
I don't think so.
Manish? No, Manish is just giggling, which is great. So,
have you got a heated blanket, Neil, or a heated mattress?
I used to have an electric blanket when I lived with my mother in the 70s. Yes, that was nice. I miss an electric blanket.
They were banned in my father's house because he feared they were a fire hazard.
Yeah, they were slightly fire hazardy, weren't they?
They were fire-ish.
Yeah. I do like a cold bed.
Can you imagine having one of those, having a brandy and missing, at night?
Yeah, bang.
They should bring back the electric blanket. I think that's an underrated thing.
I think there are still... We've got one somewhere.
It sounds like something... It always sounded a bit death row to me, the electric blanket. It doesn't sound quite right. Okay.
Yeah. What are we on?
Let's move on to the thorny subject of our favourite motorsport. Is it my favourite motorsport? I'm not sure it is. Formula One, which is very much focused on a particular issue at the moment. Manish, have a stab at what's going on now without being sued.
Yes, tricky. Can I just say first, the new Ferrari was launched today and I think the livery looks really good. Have you seen it?
No, well, it's not all black.
Black. That was really nice. Christian Horner and his problems discussed. Formula One is a pretty hardcore sport, and people have their elbows out, and people's tempers, I imagine, do fray. And as the season goes on, in these enormous seasons that we now have, I imagine people's kind of reserve diminishes. And it is alleged, although there's no evidence, that Christian Horner was, quote unquote, out of line, too abrasive, who knows what, to an employee. This employee made a complaint to human resources in Salzburg, and suddenly, Christian Horner is fighting for his job. And we've read the term coercive control thrown out there. There are rumors about rifts between him and Salzburg. I mean, the only concrete thing I can see just from the outside in terms of why he may or may not be loved by the parent company is when Helmut Marko said some very unchoice things, perhaps, about Sergio Perez last year, compared his work ethic to Max Verstappen's using their kind of continental differences. Christian did follow up by saying, well, Helmut's not an employee of Red Bull Racing. He's an employee of those people up in Salzburg. And I have to say, it was a good point. But you work together. I think loyalty, Harry Palmer says it, doesn't he? In Ipcress File, he goes, loyalty should be like a girdle; it should stretch two ways. And I think that's just a great phrase. I suppose that was the first time I could see in public that this isn't one beautiful. We all read everything, but in public, seeing that this wasn't one beautiful, homogenous, winning machine, and. It's difficult to comment on something you really don't know about, but it seems to me that this has become extremely serious very, very quickly. I mean, being questioned by a QC for 8 hours, I mean, that is sort of, that's sort of murderer territory. That's got to be, one of the toughest things you could possibly go through. Now, it also strikes me that, I don't know whether it's strategic or not, but you tell me, you think the longer this goes on, is that better for Christian or worse? Because I would argue the longer this goes on, just the worse it is, because you can't say anything in the press, you can't defend yourself, you can't talk about what it is, so the stink just... And today, that sort of paragon of virtue, as I shared with you, the Daily Mirror today said, 91-year-old Bernie Eccleston, brackets, he's 93, has advised Christian to step down. And now another paper is saying that Stefano Domenicali has joined in saying, you've got to step down. So you really do wonder, I mean, in a way, what has he done to deserve this? And we just don't know. Suddenly, probably the most successful boss, certainly in the last 3 years, may not be at the helm of a company that he's helped shape since 2005. And you know you do wonder, wow, I guess.
I'm sure the Boston Consulting Group has written a paper on the life cycle of an organization or an entity, and there must be a point at which, you know, the snake tries to eat its own tail, and Red Bull appears to be maybe reaching that point where you inevitably start to self-destruct because you're so successful, you're beating everyone, you've got to start beating yourself. You know, sorry, I need to rephrase that, but you know what I mean. but because Red Bull is the ultimate privately held edifice, we don't know what's going on. And, but the longer we don't know, the more people speculate. And I think I agree with Manish, the more speculation and silence there is, the harder it becomes for Christian Horner to survive, I think. His position becomes more difficult through no fault of his own. Or maybe that's all part of the ploy from Red Bull to string this out, or, you know, or his enemies within Red Bull. I like the speculation that comes with it, though. I think a good friend of mine on another WhatsApp group said, you know, this does provide some welcome distraction from launch season Formula One, which has gone from being a fantastic series of spectacles and ridiculous team leaders and all trying to outdo each other to just some really rather insipid, you know, reveals. Or I think Zach got it right the other day. We, you know, here's the livery of our racing cars. Shut up. We'll go racing now. These sort of half launches we have, they're not great. They're not memorable. You don't see Senna wearing an outrageous suit. You know, you just don't. So I think, and I like the Ferrari. I agree with Manish. Although I add one thing for this year. I think the rulemakers have got it wrong. I think you should be able to see the spokes of a wheel. I don't want more of these discs. I want to see the spokes of the wheel are a very important part of motion on a car when you see the films and the slow-mos. These discs, which obviously aid brake cooling, they take more and more personality and speed away from the car. I want to see a spoke.
BBS.
Fundamentally, what I love at the moment is we've got this distraction and we're all imagining, well, what does this mean? Adrian Newey's going to leave? Does this mean... it all comes under one heading. Are we going to see the end of Red Bull's dominance a bit sooner than we might otherwise have had? And it's nothing against Red Bull, but, you know, maybe we could just do with the changing of the guard. We've had a few years of this. It would be great if something else came along.
Yeah, it spices it up a bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, have you seen just how this weird season has crescendoed? We had Andretti is not going to happen. And then we had Lewis to Ferrari, and now we've got is Christian leaving Red Bull, and is it all going to imply? I mean, what a pre-season.
It's all good for liberty, isn't it? It's all good for liberty, really.
Also, can one of you clever people tell me what happened to the Wolves? Because they were under massive speculation about revealing information and exchanging information. That sort of petered out. I didn't really hear what the outcome of that was.
So, what my understanding is that there was a bit of behind the bike shed's tittle-tattle chatter that Susie in her F1 Academy role, which is essentially an FIA role, as well as a FOM role, had something like that, had been privy to information that was sensitive or material from a team point of view. And it became slightly awkward because her partner is one of the team principals of the teams. And I suspect one of the team principals, a bit grumbly, sort of off the cuff, unguarded moment, said something. What I think then happened was, because that stuff must happen all the time. Everyone's gossiping and moaning about everybody else. The difference on that occasion was MBS, not the Saudi one, the sporting one, in his attempt to assert himself as being in charge, grabbed onto this thing without any kind of filtering or whatever and said, aha, I can assert control. At which point, all of the teams said, well, it wasn't me. And more beyond that, then said, well, actually, we think it's a grotesque attack on Susie. How dare they? And Susie is absolutely spitting feathers about it. She wants blood for this, and she hasn't had it yet. So poor old M. Mohammed bin Sulayem found himself thinking, well, hang on, but but the person who said something to you, Mohammed, didn't want to go public, and therefore you're sat there with your trousers down. So that's why it's all gone away. It was a tittle-tattle thing, I suspect. And when he tried running with it, he realized he didn't have any friends, which he should have known anyway. So that's why it went away.
Is it a sport or a playground? It's amazing. I do love it. It's very appealing,
well,
isn't it?
It's both, which is why it's so entertaining. And I'm with Neil. I think this, we saw the Alonso thing. There was a fantastic interview with Alonso. I mean, he knows how to get under people's skin. And when he said,
he's cool.
Well, I don't remember Lewis having a dream about Ferrari last year.
Yeah.
I don't
remember. Childhood dream about it.
And, oh, yeah. And now, of course, you know, there's only three world champions, only three fast world champions. And I'm the only fast world champion that's now available. So, yeah, I'm really interested to see what's happening in 2025. Because I'm, you know, and actually, I've just done some medical tests and I could go on to 50.
Can I read that quotation? Because I love this.
Go on. Yeah.
Fly dig at every one-time world champion over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
There are only three world champions on the grid and fast world champions. Because in the past, maybe there were some champions who were maybe not so committed to be fast.
Yeah.
He's just there with his Rosberg t-shirt on going...
Yeah.
Do you know what he is, Alonso? I've got a word for it, and I use it to describe my children sometimes. He's naughty.
Yeah.
He's just naughty.
He's brilliant.
Anyone got any F1 stuff to add there?
When's the first race?
When did we find out about the quali and how fast cars are and all that?
Testing, 29th.
Well, testing in Bahrain's next week.
Yeah.
I never
think you find out. Do you find out very much from testing? They're so naughty.
I think you get an indication. They're clever, yeah. But you do get the long runs, you get an indication. There'll be nerds. You know, Mark Hughes will spot something and then he'll feed it back to the rest of us. The quirk of the opening race is it's on a Saturday, not a Sunday.
Yeah, it's Ramadan.
And that has not been publicised that much, I don't think. It's on a Saturday, not a Sunday.
It's a nighttime race, yeah.
Yeah.
They're testing, are they? And then they just do the race. They all stay in Bahrain and have a holiday.
Morning week, but yeah, basically. Well, they're out there because then Jeddah.
Yeah, it's to do with Ramadan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Sorry to speak over you, Chris. I apologise. I could hear your mouth moving, but I couldn't hear anything. It's like when we used to travel to the Nürburgring together. love you. We're going to move on to our two-car garage, if that's all right, because we're an hour and a half in. This is episode 52, is a long one. Today's two-car garage comes from Mitchell Iceland, 4593.
Mitchell Cleland.
Oh, my God, there you go. That's how you read it. Mitchell Cleland. Sorry, I saw an I in front, an L in front of the C.
Sorry, Mitchell.
Cleland. Mitchell Cleland, sorry about that, Mitchell. 4593. Tell you what, I can't actually read it. Wait then.
Shall I read it?
No, because I want to get my specs out. It's going so quickly, this. Now look at that. Two-car garage suggestion. Your 50th birthday is looming. You run a successful catering company and decided to treat yourself to a new, to you, two-car garage. You need a daily, which you can use to visit clients, brackets, not too ostentatious, spy on competitors, and it's relatively economical and practical. You also want something for a bit of fun at the weekend. You're beginning to realise that power isn't everything and driving and fun is more important. Thus, you're looking for something that is most fun to drive under triple digits. The sweet spot when you're significant...
I think he meant significant other.
Yeah, it doesn't say you're driving too fast. Having just engine swapped your eldest son's Mini R53, you are open to something that may require some mechanical TLC. The budget, the same amount you can't bring yourself to spend on a 992 Carrera, £90,000. Love the podcast. Keep up the great work. We love a compliment, the addicts. The addicts love a little compliment. They really do. They get all warm in the tummy. I'm going to go first to Manish.
So I was trying to look for these banana skins and I thought, is he a bit of a catering spy as well as turning up? And I didn't know what a catering spy sort of is. Is it somebody goes and looks to see what kind of icing other people's cream cakes have? I have no idea. But
correct.
I think,
yeah, what sort of hors d'oeuvres they're serving at other people's weddings. Yeah. It's a wedding crash.
That kind of thing. And then also... presumably he's going to want some of this to do some delivery. So I thought it had to be an estate, it had to be a touring. You know, he needs a bit of room. And then I think what I decided to do was he's going to break what I call Cooper's rule. And he's going to go for as much dark glass as he possibly can.
That is a rule.
Yeah.
I think he's going to hide his own catering in the back. And he's going to try to hide himself in the front. So I think he's going to go non-standard tinted windows, about as dark as they can get. Then I like the parsimonious angle. You know, he wants lots and lots of mileage for his gallon of diesel, I've decided. And I found for £40,000, it's rather pretty, AMG C-Class Touring, 220. I think it's quick. It's kind of nondescript, but if you look at it more closely, you see it's got something special about it. And I can get a lot of hors d'oeuvres into the back, but at £40,000, and this is another little homage to Mr. Cooper, it leaves you £50,000 to get. I think this thing is beautiful. It's the Caterham 420 RSV.
Oh, we're very close on this one, Manish, you and me.
Look at this. I mean, it's yellow with black leather. And I actually love it. Liquid yellow pearl. What a name. And 210 horsepower in a car like that is ample. And I think sub 100 miles an hour with your Momo steering wheel, your carbon fiber dash, I think you'd look good and feel better. So that's my two-car garage and £50,000.
Yeah.
So I'm 3,000 over, but I think with Mr. Lovett's sort of negotiating skill, I think I can get that Merc down a bit. So I'm there for about £90,000. Hors d'oeuvres and hot yellow beast.
Edward.
I've spent $1 million and I'm a drug dealer that's moved to LA. Is that right?
Right, okay. So just to be clear, we had another potential two-car garage that Edward preferred. And he might answer that one this week. Go on. You're just doing neither of them, Edward.
No, I have. I did do one for the 50-year-old. It's a bit boring. And now, clear, I'm not going to do something too practical. So I'm going to go for an AMG, but I'm going to go for an E-Class, still an estate. So an E63S, but D badge it and all that sort of jazz.
What sort of mileage are you getting?
Obviously, because he's trying to be, he's spying, we're going to have to black out the back windows and the front windows so no one could see him through there. So,
you make good points.
Good. So he's not a drug dealer, but he is an undercover catering spy. So
hard to tell those two professions apart, isn't it?
Yeah. Undercover catering spy. Neil Clifford, what's your preferred wheels?
I've got a sports car. Now, I've had a very busy day and I couldn't really start thinking about what he's going to work on. So, he can spend the other bit of money on a 718 Boxster GTS. Yeah. That'll do him just right for the weekend. Good little pair of cars, that.
Thank you for sparing the time to think of those, Edward. It's great.
Thanks. And by the way, a Boxster is, my mother had Boxsters when I was growing up, and they were a very practical car for anyone that needed to do large shops because they had a frunk and a boot.
Yep. Yeah. I just bought a Boxster.
Yeah.
How old?
Good bloody question. 2005, I think.
Oh, an early one.
Yeah. Good. With the yellow
Is it a 2.5?
It's 3.2S.
Oh, first with the nicer lights. Yeah.
On that note, Neil Clifford, what's your two-car garage?
Right. A 50-year-old entrepreneur running his own successful catering company. He's got to have a Jag. It's got to be a Jaguar, isn't it? And he's going XJR, the V8. Everyone says the 6 is better, but bollocks. You want a V8. Don't you?
Yeah.
You want that last one, whatever it was called, the portfolio.
Yeah.
One, right? The black XJR 2005, I think it was. Actually, they were like 7995, weren't they, about 5 years ago? They're like 20 grand now. But like, it's the king of the Jaguar pretty car XJR. 150 miles an hour. You're telling everyone in your village that you are a successful dude, and that's what a Jaguar is all about. And then the word spy says, as we've discussed already, Aston Martin. He's got to have an Aston Martin. Because, you know, everyone wants that. If only Lawrence realised that you just got to be fucking James Bond. Anyone who buys an Aston Martin wants to be James Bond. And you've got 50 grand, I suppose, or something, or maybe 70 grand. You want the last, in my view, of the pretty Astons, really, was the Vantage, not this one that's now been made a little bit less ugly with the front, but the proper Vantage, S, V12.
Manual. Yeah.
And, you know, you can't really get a cab because they've all gone up. They're almost 100 grand now. But for a coupe, V12 S, it's about 70 grand. Lovely. Last of the pretty Aston, in my view, apart from the Victor and all that. That is a gorgeous car. It's probably going to break down because it's not quite as good as a Ferrari or a Porsche. So you can fiddle around with it by ringing the AA and talk to Chris Harris on the side of the motorway on the M32 or wherever you were, Mr. Harris. So Jaguar and Aston, British, successful entrepreneur.
Baker.
Yeah.
Yes. The worst cars on which to be discreet and spy on people. You look like you're an extra from a Guy Ritchie movie. You might as well be walking around with a baseball bat. Right. Yeah.
Love it. You can imagine him getting out to spy in his dinner suit.
Yes. Chris Cooper.
I had quite a bit of fun with this one. So Finn and Cam and I were talking about this earlier on. We got four. So Mitchell, choice for you and Mrs. Cleland. The daily one, a G30 M5 2019. We found one 26,000 miles for 44k.
Whoa.
Debadge it. It had clear glass, which I know, even if I'm a spy, I kind of, you know, but it's got, it could look like, you know, debadge, could look like a 520 diesel. Nice and, but it would get them around a bit. I'd love to know more. In fact, Mitchell, could you next on the comments next week tell us a bit more about your predilection for spying and which sectors of the catering marketplace you think are giving you most interest, espionage style? For the bit of fun
chart, the chicken tikka masala microwavable, I think that is probably.
That sounds like a business opportunity. C6 Z06 Corvette, 7 liters, 2006, 41 grand. That was, in fact, actually, Cam found a black one, black wheels, black glass, and everything. I thought, do you know what? You could, people would hear and see you coming, but they wouldn't know who it is.
Yep.
Wouldn't know who it is. We also had an Aston Martin Vantage Roadster 2014.
That's the ugly one, though, isn't it?
It's the one you were saying. It's the one that was the vertical.
Just to be clear, your budget is what, 600 grand or what?
No. and the last one, and Manish, you and I were close on this one as well. We found an R500 K Series Caterham.
Oh, I'd like one of those again.
And I think that would be up to 100 miles an hour. Mrs. Cleland, because I think Mrs. Cleland won't know that Mitchell is a catering espionage operative.
No.
I think she'll just be completely oblivious. Maybe. And she'll wonder why he's got these nice cars, and he'll come home in the evening and it'll be ticking. The car will be ticking a lot, like it's had a really, really good thrash. And she'll think, he loves his cars. He must go some really interesting places to get the car so hot. She won't know. It's because he's been doing spy stuff.
He's been
on this one. County lines
catering capers.
Yes.
Do you remember that film where Arnold Schwarzenegger was a spy and his wife didn't know that he was one?
True Lies. Yeah. Brilliant film. Okay.
Right. My two-car garage is just changed, actually, because of a message being sent to me by a friend of mine who is very good at looking after Nissan GTRs. So the everyday car that's roadable, that can be involved in food espionage, is for me very straightforward. It's a hot hatch that's the best I've driven on the road. It's very, very subtle looking, and it plays into the fact this guy's 50 years old. So he's one of my generation. He's the front wheel drive generation. and it's the latest Civic Type R. If you get it in black with clear glass, it just looks like a normal hatchback. And on the road, it's about as good a road car as I've ever driven. Go and drive one. They are knockout. They're absolutely knockout. And he's bought that, and he's been all over the place, just spying on people, on catering vans, what people are doing in the food industry. And he's not been caught. So it served its purpose. And he goes home one night and he thinks, I've still got 45 grand left to buy a nice sports car. And I don't want anything that goes too fast. I want to get my fuels below 100 miles an hour. But he goes on to an auction website called Collecting Cars and he's bidding. And he happens to be bidding tonight of all nights. And a car ends, and he's about to end, and he's thinking, this is an extraordinary price for this vehicle. And this has just happened as we're recording. We've just sold a McLaren MP4 12C for 46 grand. 46,999.
I was watching that.
And he's looking at that, he's bidding, and he hears his inner Neil Clifford voice goes, fuck it, I don't care about going slower than 100. It's too good a car for that money. So he buys that. He's bought a 12C for a nugget under £47,000, which I think is remarkable.
That's a steal.
What about that one, Manish?
That car looked like it had a story to it to me. that's what he's going to have. He's got an MP412C, a full Ron Dennis named car for that. Yeah. I mean, that's M3 money. Outrageous.
Yeah, that's good.
Right. Let's do some music before we go, because we're a long way into this one, boys. I'm going to start with music this week, because there's one type of driving music experience we haven't discussed, and that is late at night driving very, very fast to very slow-moving music can be a really, really pleasant exercise. Super high velocity sometimes on an autobahn listening to a soothing tune. So I'm imagining that I'm in a Porsche 928 with that lovely dashboard glow. Okay, but I'm doing $150 legally down the autobahn on my way back from work at Frankfurt, where I've been making loads of money with my red braces on. But I've got Leonard Cohen's Suzanne playing, because it's a great tune. I love it. I just love the lyrics. And I listened to it the other day going quite quick myself, and I enjoyed the slow, languid voice of that man and the very, very fast moving car. There you go. Ed would love it next.
I was listening to 90s music today and going on my Spotify. So I've gone sort of semi-90s club music, which is The Source, You've Got the Love.
Cool. Yep.
Manish.
I like your theme of driving late at night very, very quickly in a straight line to a piece of much more languid music. And I would direct you to Japan's album, Gentlemen Take Polaroids, and there's a track on that called Swing.
Good album, that.
You will love listening to Swing in the middle
David
of the
Sylvian.
Night. Yeah, beautiful voice, very, very, very good piece of music.
What's the name of the album?
Swing. Gentlemen Take Polaroids.
Okay. That's great.
It's a good album.
Neil Clifford.
Well, we had we haven't pre-recorded this, so we had some very sad news, didn't we, this evening, that Steve Wright passed away.
Yes.
Oh.
And you know, whatever you want to say about him, he was the voice of our 80s and 90s, wasn't he, on Radio One?
Yeah.
So R.I.P. Steve Wright, bit of a player, really. And I thought, what is the most Steve Wright loveliness of songs? And it's going to be a sort of lush 80s love song, isn't it? So I've chosen One More Night by Phil Collins, because it says everything to me about 1985 or whenever that was. It's just a lovely thing, and
yeah,
and Steve Wright was a dude.
Yeah, bless him.
Yeah, R.I.P. I went on.
He started on my local radio station, Radio 210.
Did he?
Yeah.
I did his show when I was doing the television thing, and he was really, really kind, lovely man.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Chris Cooper.
So, I'm kind of also on the driving fast at night, something really soothing, and just driving down to Cornwall late at night, particularly in the summer, when you see that glow on the horizon, Groove Armada at the river.
Ooh.
It's just lovely.
Good tune. Okay. Before we end, we received a lovely heartfelt message from a chap called Ed, telling us the reasons why he had enjoyed our podcast in the last year. It's a private message, but a message to you, Ed. We appreciate your predicament. Send you lots and lots of love and keep listening. That's the end of episode 52. Twas a long one. Please join us again next week. Manish Pandey, Edward Lovett, Chris Cooper, Neil Clifford and myself. Thank you very much for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.